You're listening to episode 3 of Well Made, a podcast presented by Lumi about the intersection between business and design. I'm Stefan Engo, co-founder of Lumi, and today we're sharing a live episode of the podcast that was recorded a few weeks ago during a big design event that we held at Lumi HQ in Los Angeles. I'm joined by Mike McAdan, the founder of This Is Ground, a brand of beautiful leather accessories. Mike has a fascinating background as a user interface designer, and we dig into his transition from digital to physical design, as well as take a few questions from the audience.
So without further ado, I will welcome up our speaker and moderator, Stefan and Mike.
So I was up at your new warehouse. You guys are neighbors of ours now. You just moved in like a week ago, and it's a beautiful space. And we had a little conversation, and I made a list of topics, and I said, stop talking about this. And so I have the weirdest list of words here. It says blimp, science, running man, Italy, Apple Store. And so hopefully we'll try and cover some of those and what those means. I don't even know, actually. But why don't you give us like a 49-second version of who you are and what you're up to?
My name is Mike McAdan. I'm from the Bay Area. I was born and raised up there, but I've always kind of seen between San Diego and Vancouver, British Columbia, as just sort of one space. And my background is on the design part. It actually started with a lot of this stuff, and one of the reasons why I'm so buzzy right now is I'm super excited and inspired by everything that I just saw in there, because before digital, it was all about traditional graphic design, and I actually had drafting tables and tech pens, and I shot photostats and did corrugated cartons. So I have this really weird entry into design by way of being a production artist in that realm. And then when I went back home in San Francisco in the late 90s, I made this proclamation and I became a web designer, like a digital designer. And I remember calling my friend Bill Weatherill one day and I was like, no more graphic design for print. I'm now a web designer. And I bought a book that was like how to build a website in 14 days. And you should see that website that I built in 14 days. It's on the Wayback Machine. It's pretty astounding. And then I've never really been the sort of person that would plot out a course and then tackle one goal at a time. I was a little bit more of a free spirit and would just sort of accept opportunities and challenges as they came along. And so the first set of challenges, I was a little late. Jeff Veen and that class kind of started a little bit earlier than I did on the internet. And so by the time I got in there, it was like the cleanup crew. For some reason, I was trying to help brands that were either trying to get in there and be cool. Like one of my first big projects was for Disney. Disney bought this web portal called InfoSeek, and they turned it into go.com. And they were trying to sort of compete with Yahoo and all of these other portals. So that's like that was a big part of my existence. And then it just became turnaround projects. Intuit hired me to redesign TurboTax. They had a little bit of a retention problem. And then probably the biggest turnaround project that I've ever worked on was MySpace. And so at MySpace, Rupert Murdoch and the fun team at Fox put together a team to basically put lipstick on a pig and sell that thing.
Was that the version that...
that's not what they told me.
Was that the version that Justin Timberlake was involved in?
Justin Timberlake actually bought the pig with the lipstick on it.
Nice.
And one day I found out that Justin Timberlake actually took my job. He was the new creative director, so I had some
not,
fun
Not
with
many
that.
People can say that. That's a good... Put that on
it
your resume.
It could be worse. I mean, like, I don't know. I guess it's better than, say, Nick Cannon or something. I don't know. There's a lot of this like Lady Gaga was the creative director for Polaroid. There's a lot of this weird like.
Will I Am is at Intel. I heard.
Yeah.
I don't know what they really do for those companies.
Oh, actually, Trent Reznor was the creative director on the Beats app.
You're one of many amazing
invisible
contributors. Yeah.
So So basically, after MySpace, I was like, oh my God, it's like those turnaround projects took a really large bite out of me. And then I thought that what I'd really missed out on was starting new companies from scratch and not trying to solve big brand problems for existing companies. So when I was commuting down to LA a lot from February from 2007 to like 2009, and every time I tried to leave, there was some new interesting project that came along, like, hey, let's redesign MySpace. And I was like, gosh, you know, MySpace at the time was like the Exxon Valdez. It was the biggest disaster on the internet. So I was like, of course I have to take that project on, you know? So the funny thing about that real quick, though, is that I thought that I got the job as sort of the head of design, but that when I showed up, they were like, all right, you're in charge of product. And I was like, what? I'd never been a product manager, and they asked me to go fire a bunch of people, and I was like, God, this is not getting off to a great start. So that was a fascinating project. So after MySpace, when I tried to go back home to the Bay Area, the guy that was the president of MySpace, Mike Jones, not the rapper, not that Mike Jones, different Mike Jones, was like, oh, I just raised $10 million, let's go start an incubator. I was like, what does that mean? So we went and started this thing called Science, and at Science, the first few projects that we kicked off were like Dollar Shave Club, MeUndies, Dog Vacay, and probably 40 other projects that are now dead, probably. That was sort of applying the same level of creative energy, only towards things that were brand new. So I was like, oh, I'm in a much better position to succeed now, because I wasn't trying to fix something that had already been established. So, and by the way, back to MySpace, on day two, I told them, just change the name. No one wants to go to MySpace. Because they still had free music. It was awesome.
Does it still exist?
I don't know. You don't know?
No. Oh, yeah. I've never been there. Not in years.
I don't know. That's a good question. Someone should look it up.
Update from the audience, it still exists.
Alert. We're good. MySpace is still there. So I was doing the incubator thing, lots of new businesses, and then in the process of doing those new businesses, I moved downtown and was like really fascinated with what was going on downtown. And there was, like Jesse was saying on her tour, you're just completely immersed in all of these really wonderful businesses and companies that offer really amazing things. And I discovered leather. And so I just started making myself accessories for friends and family, wallets, iPhone cases, just to save some money and to teach myself a new craft. So I watched Tandy videos on YouTube. I started sewing. And then one day, a friend that was working on an editorial piece for Refinery 29 said, hey, can you come up with an interesting way to organize cables, like cords? And I had just had tacos. And for some reason, I was like, well, the taco shell is a pretty amazing architecture concept, because it's just this really simple geometric form that's responsible for so much, you know? Think about all you can stuff in a taco shell, and you just close it up, and it just works. So I prototyped the cord taco the next morning out of tinfoil and tape, and when I saw that it worked, I was first relieved, because I had not created anything for this story. I totally procrastinated, so... And then I Googled cord taco, and no one had done the cord taco. And I was like, really? All right. So I like opened up an Etsy store, and 2 weeks later, I sold $20,000 worth of cord tacos because Uncrate posted it. And now we've sold over 1 million cord tacos.
Can I just ask a question? How many of you have heard of This Is Ground or cord tacos? Okay. I'm pretty good.
Or a taco. How many have heard of a taco?
That was like 20% maybe.
Yeah, not bad. I wish it was better here in L.A. We actually saw them in Kazakhstan, which is interesting. Yeah.
Wow. The birthplace of Borat. I don't know.
Exactly.
That's all I know about Kazakhstan. I think, do you know what I know about Kazakhstan? Apples are actually from Kazakhstan originally.
Really?
That's my fact about Kazakhstan. Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Just trying to make this educational for people. So cord taco...
Yeah, cord taco. And then it was funny because so my job at Science was, while they were doing all of these sort of paid acquisition, customer acquisition t- tactics. That's a world that I know makes sense and works for a lot of businesses, and I certainly appreciate SEO and all that kind of stuff, but they wanted me to also sort of work on the organic side of a brand so that once they paid for the advertising, you know, once they paid for customers to get there, that they would actually stumble upon something that they would buy and not be unhappy about it. So, you know, Dollar Shave Club is probably one of the best examples of that, because for some reason that just drives so much delight with people, that project. And so one of the things, though, when I started the Cord Taco thing, is I just started like giving away Cord Tacos in the office, and everyone thought I was insane. And my partners were like, you're not, are you gonna do this as a business now? And I'm like, well, why not? And they didn't really have faith that I could build, in their eyes, a business that wasn't doing $100 million in revenue a year or something, like was like not worth talking about. So I just said, well, we'll start with the Cord Taco. It's a really amazing sort of philosophy because it embodies all of these really wonderful things. It organizes cables, it solves a frustration. It's simple, it's repeatable, you can manufacture them really easily. I can do them downtown. I don't have to like outsource this to another country, not that there's anything wrong with that. And we'll start there and we'll see what happens. And I said, listen, I predict that in 2 years I'll have a weekender travel bag that will have some kind of technology in it, like Wi-Fi. And they kind of laughed. And so, about a year ago, I left science, and about 6 months ago, I launched a bag that's $1,000 and it has Wi-Fi. So, and they sell great. It's an awesome business. And it's right down the street.
Pretty good. I think you went over the 49 seconds, but...
Sorry.
It's close enough.
Why'd you pick 49?
It was random. Where did the name This Is Grand come from?
Good question. So in my early 20s, I was on an airship tour. It was Richard Branson's blimps. He had a fleet of blimps that would carry cameras for NASCAR races and baseball games. And so I went on this tour, and I would communicate with the pilot by saying 560 Alpha Bravo, This Is Ground. So,
wow.
And This Is Ground was sort of when I became fascinated with organizing really obscure things, because we were carrying around helium tanks and hoses and a blimp around the country. So that's where This Is Grand. It's also part of one of my favorite songs by David Bowie. So, yeah.
So in the transition from doing mostly digital products to now physical products, like, was it just tapping into a curiosity that you had? Where'd that come from?
Well, I think one of the first things that happened was, you know, you guys do digital design here, right? Yeah. So I was there sort of in the beginning, and it's a very uncomfortable space. You know, you have people at the computer maybe doing their taxes, and it was the first time that I'd actually seen people cry when they were experiencing things that I made. Like, people, I literally saw someone in a usability study cry, like, they're trying to do her taxes. So there was never anything that comfortable about just a flat digital interface, but I did it because the money was good and someone needed to do it, and it was fun, like it was a great job. And so, but when I made a wallet, it was actually a wallet that was also a phone case, and I gave it to my friend Sega, and he had a reaction, like a really emotional reaction. And the thing about leather too, you have to keep in mind, is people smell leather goods. That's usually one of the first things they do. And some people do that just to, it's like a validation, is this really leather? And some people do it because it conjures up memories of like grandparents and cars, I don't know. So Sega did that, and then he put it in his pocket, and it was like real time delight that I witnessed right in front of me over a wallet that took me 10 minutes to make, you know? And it was just this kind of grounding moment as a designer where I was like, oh, that's what that feels like. Because I'd never in 15 years had anyone had that much delight with anything that I ever made on the internet.
And do you still get involved in some digital stuff? I mean, you guys have a beautiful website. There's a crossover between the two disciplines, certainly.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, more from a storytelling standpoint. So we do a lot of marketing, and we have an e-commerce store, and now we're going to be expanding and improving the experience internationally. So there's a lot of localization in different parts of the world, and so
yeah. Talk about Italy a little bit, because you're starting to get involved in manufacturing over there, which is kind of like the mecca when it comes to leather goods, right?
Yeah, they're like the Silicon Valley of leather. So what happened here in LA was essentially I was making corn tacos in my kitchen, cutting my fingers, just nights and weekends were lost. And then I started working with some factories that I found here in LA. And in doing so, I would meet the real people doing the work, the real artisans at these factories were people that were, you know, kind of in it, a couple generations old. And when they caught wind that I was an entrepreneur, they asked me, they basically came to me. They got together and they came to me and they said, you know, we're tired of working for the man. Can you help us? We want to be our own boss and want to make a little bit more cash. So I said, yes, I can help you. So I said, why don't we build you a factory of your own? And my only request is that as long as I can keep you busy enough, we'll be your exclusive client and you'll be right across the hall. Because in my mind, it was kind of like having design and dev together, you know? So they were totally on board with that. And so we did that last year. We had a factory across the hall and it was wonderful. We bought all their equipment and the space. And then this last holiday season, unfortunately, the business is growing and they can't make enough product for us. So we had to expand. And the thing that the decision of going into Italy was A, because they're really good at making leather goods, B, that's where our leather comes from, and C, it gave us a reason to now develop a model where we're going to sort of expand locally into Europe, and just so we'll still make product here in LA, it's just that we'll also make it in Italy as well, and that'll serve that region of the world, and then they won't have to pay duties and the rest of the fees and wait that long to get their product. So yeah, like a month ago, I went to Italy. I flew to Milan. I rented a car and drove around Italy and interviewed three factories and went to the tanneries. And now April 1st, we'll start to distribute product out of the UK that's made in Italy.
Tell me more about the factories. Like, what did you learn over there? How is it different from, I mean, LA is an incredible manufacturing city. We have all kinds of craftsmen, people there. Italy seems to be on a whole nother level.
Yeah, I think it's a bit more established and older, and there's a lot of family history with the Pelletieris that make the stuff there, and they are people that it's like if you've ever worked with that developer that doesn't like to release any sloppy code and it isn't like perfect fidelity with the way you've designed it. That's what they are. They're just like bringing up things that I wasn't even thinking about. So they're just super, super good and super tasteful and super picky about the quality and the craftsmanship of the work.
Yeah.
And so and they're really excited that this sort of growing American brand that has introduced technology into leather accessories is interested in working with them. They're fascinated by it.
I'm fascinated by the idea of what happens to things like web design when people will have been doing it for hundreds of years, you know, because that's an amazing thing about leather and other things that can be manufactured. There are experts and craftsmen who've been doing it for so long that there's certain ways to do it right. We're still kind of in the middle of it when it comes to the digital side of design, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think that we're still dealing with a lot of unnecessary constraints. So,
what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I think when you're tethered to anything like a computer or larger devices to do things like ATM machines and this sort of thing, it just introduces constraints that make the whole experience super uncomfortable from the outset. So, I can't even imagine. I just don't even know if there'll be flat interfaces, you know? I don't think there will be.
It's hard to imagine because, so you mentioned the web archives where we can find your first website that you made in 14 days, but who knows how long that stuff is going to be around. A lot of the digital designs that we make, how will historians look at it in you know, 100 years? I don't know. It's a very different thing. Does your interest in physical goods relate to that? Like, there's something about digital design that is so ephemeral, and then there's something about physical design that has the power to like stick around.
Yeah, it was one of the things that really scared me. Well, actually, it didn't scare me. It was pretty liberating going from print design, where you're committing your design to something that will theoretically last forever, to code, which you can just change and transform. So I think that with it puts me back on the spot again. I'm putting things out there that will theoretically last forever. And that's the thing that the Italians, you know, that's how they build things, is that they're going to last forever. So when you see someone with a really badass, like, you know, satchel from the 70s, and it has patina, and whoever designed it in a way where it still accommodates things that people carry today, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
So I don't know that we'll necessarily have the same experience with old websites. I mean, I think it's a fascinating idea. I think it's cool. But maybe like microfiche or holograms or augmented reality somewhere in some archives. Like, I don't know. But I like the idea that there's this sort of level of responsibility when you put something that's physical out there, that it has to live in an environment next to other objects, that it just forces you to think about things in a completely different way.
I'm curious to hear, what is the hardest thing so far about starting This Is Ground?
I think not living, like, I'm running a business, but I'm also just a designer, so, you know, when I'm on calls with attorneys and finance and all that, that I know is important, and I'm trying to be inspired creatively by all that stuff, but I just can't seem to get excited about it. That's tough, but it's okay. Like, it's actually not that hard, and the way that I usually resolve it is that there is so much nonsense in the world. You know, there's just so much. The last attorney I hired was on upcounsel.com, and it's because Target knocked off our Cord Taco. So I could have spent $10,000 on a really fancy IP attorney to chase after Target, or I could have went to the TaskRabbit of attorneys, which seems to be UpCounsel, and I think I paid the guy $100, and I was maybe on one phone call. These are attorneys that want to do legal work on their commute to their day job. So it's like super cheap. And that's the level that I want. Like, I don't want to go beyond the commute call. Like, no offense to attorneys, it's just not a fascinating world to me. So, and that $150 that I spent, like, Target is sending me a check for, I'm not supposed to say, but there, it's being resolved, you know? So,
right. That's an actionable tip.
Yeah, UpCounsel, there you go.
Sounds like that turned out pretty easy, actually. I thought that would be harder. I'm going to have to look into that site.
It would have been harder if I didn't protect the Cord Taco, but we made the decision early on to spend the $3,000 to get a patent on it and to trademark the name Cord Taco. And I don't, you know, this is a lot of, there's a lot of controversy around legal protection, around intellectual property and what it does to the ability to innovate. But I think that when, I think there's the positive for me is that if we live in a world where everyone is just copying, then obviously we won't evolve and we won't innovate. So, you know, people should be forced to come up with something original.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that hard.
Well, and one thing that's interesting is you guys mostly do sales online. Is that correct? So there isn't a place yet for Target to buy the Cord Taco from you and resell it. I'm just curious, like, how do you approach that decision?
We have a link on our footer, and it will connect you with Joe Schmidt, who does biz dev for things like that. But Target, it just isn't really in our plans this year.
Yeah.
Maybe next year. I didn't want to have to be forced to make a decision what to be in Target or not. So the people that knocked the Cord Taco off really kind of disrupted that. And you know, as you guys, I'm sure, know, when someone copies your stuff, there's a very strong emotional reaction at first, and you use explicatives that you didn't even know existed, and it's like you can't even believe it, and it presents a really big question. Do I then live on these phone calls with attorneys and try to chase down everybody that's trying to do the Cord Taco, or do I just kind of let it go and I have no religion? And I think the way we've resolved that is that. If people want to knock off the Cord Taco on Etsy and smaller independent designers, I say go for it. I do get a little upset when they use the name Cord Taco because it just confuses it on Google with SEO. When a company like Target does it, it irritates me. You know, because they have the resources to get in touch with us and to do some kind of a licensing deal, and they should be fair about that. So. I don't, my religion is a little balanced.
Yeah.
at this point on the Court Taco. Like, it's going to happen, you know. So,
do you want to talk about your experience with Apple and getting with the Apple Store or anything like that? I'm curious going down this path of what is it like bringing a product to retail?
I have to say, like, I grew up, you know, even during the Scully 90 years on Apple, I've always been an Apple fanboy, I'll admit it. And so when they wanted to sell my product, I peed my pants. And, like, it was...
Enjoy, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
It was really exciting. And it was a real big sort of, I don't know, it was really cool. Then when you get into selling stuff at Apple, that's when you realize what it really means. And this I will try to keep short, but what it really meant for us was I flew to Cupertino, I met with them, and they gave me a list of distributors that I had to work with. They were their preferred distributors. We picked one that was here on the West Coast because I thought being in the same time zone would be beneficial. We started selling Cord Tacos and another product that we do called the Cordito, and they're doing really well, and they ended up selling out. But then the distributor that Apple wanted us to go with ended up filing for bankruptcy. And so we lost, you know, tens of thousands of dollars on the thing. And then I was like, okay, I get it. That was probably an anomaly. I forgive you, Apple. And then we go with, you know, distributor number two, which is probably one of the biggest distributors that they work with. And that is just, I'm never going to sell anything at Apple after this, but it's a bit of a racket, the whole thing. You know, because if you think about it, you, first of all, for wholesale, you have to discount yourself, your stuff 50%. And then there's usually an additional 10%, like for distributors, and people want commission, and you've got someone representing you in another country that wants 5%. When all is said and done, you're like, so I just did this for nothing. Yeah, but you're building a brand, you know? Like, it's all good. It's discovery. It's exposure. But there's just other ways, you know, to do that. So my experience with Apple, I would say, was good because it's kind of like getting into the Ivy League school. Once Apple starts selling your stuff, like, it opens up all kinds of doors, and that's it. When they asked me to be in their actual physical store, so we only did it actually on their website. When they did it, sorry about that. That was someone at Apple. That's really pissed off. Sorry. When they inquired about being in the actual store, then it was like an additional 20% for packaging, and I was like, you know what, I don't think we want to be in the Apple store. We're doing really well. There is no better land for us than direct to consumer through our Shopify website, and I've probably been on Shopify too long by now. I probably should have my own build out, but it's in that world where you're going direct to consumer, you control the entire experience. You get to establish the relationship with the consumer so that you can, you know, have follow-up communication with them. You get to make, you know, the profit and reinvest it in your growing business. So that's the world that I really love.
Hey, this is Stefan. Quick note, we weren't able to pick up the voices of the people asking questions, but thinking ahead, I did repeat them. So that's what you'll hear in the next segment. Now, back to the show.
What was it, the major product blow up, is the question. What were the engines of growth for you?
So we've always been really generous with samples to people that we saw as sort of our personas, our audience. So for us, it's people in creative arts. So it's designers, illustrators, photographers, chefs, bartenders. So when they reach out and we think that they would do a good job of helping us tell our own story, we would just gift them product. That was one. Number two was press. So, you know, I think Swiss Miss was the first, you know, Tina was like the first person I reached out to and I said, hey, I've got this thing called the Court Taco. And she answered immediately. And it was like 2 a.m. her time. So, you know, bloggers and other channels like that I respect, I would spoil with gifts. The biggest one was Uncrate. So Uncrate.com, if you're not familiar, is sort of I think it's like a little bit skewed more towards men and like kind of crazy things. But the morning that they put the Cord Taco on, you know, that's when my Shopify, oh, it was Etsy at the time. Whenever you made a sale on Etsy, you get a little cha-ching, and then the thing was like smoke. My phone was smoking, cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching. So those two things probably were the largest. We made a decision in the beginning not to pay for advertising. I've never paid for SEO or anything like that. I probably should at this point, but we've always just tried to find people that could tell our story, and we put a lot of effort into our Instagram and connect with people that way as well. And so we end up with these super fans. Like Alton Brown was in our place for like half the day a couple days ago, and if you look at his Instagram, he posted what we gave him a makeover, and we moved him into our new backpack, which is this guy right here. So just kind of being friendly with the community, you know, and telling them about our stuff and sharing our story has been really helpful.
What is the change in your design process going from digital to physical?
It's pretty much the same. I mean, it is. I mean, you know, most of my design process comes from the books of IDEO, and it's about, you know, observational research and studying how people live and just familiarizing yourself with the frustrations that exist in the world and starting there. I made the mistake early on in my design career to think that I could just come up with all of the problems and just kind of do it on my own. But it's the same thing that we did in digital that we apply to our leather products. And so we tend to identify a problem, and then we'll very quickly, we'll do rapid prototyping. We'll make samples. We'll get them to different parts of the world, and then have them feed us feedback. So it'll be like sort of, they'll have journals, and they'll do it that way. And sometimes we publish that information as well because it's valuable for other projects. And then we refine. So this backpack right here took about 10 different prototypes that we would send around the world. And this backpack does really specific things like, it doubles as your TSA tray, so you don't have to take your laptop and put it into one of their crummy plastic trays. You can just zip this thing all the way open, and it'll go, you know, so it has, like, the tile tracker built in. It has all this stuff that we had theories on, but we didn't know how people, say, in Australia, were going to react to it. So a lot of testing, very consumer-oriented process.
When did you know that you were ready to move on from science and start your company?
That's a good question. I don't know if I kept track of it, but there's a point when you know it's a real business, and you can tell from the revenue. I've seen a lot of businesses at science that you kind of know in the first, say, couple months whether it's going to be successful or not. Like Dollar Shave Club was an instant hit. It broke the internet, and they did awesome, and you know that was obvious. This one I knew because I felt like the Cord Taco that we created did something that is difficult to do, which is that it sort of it teases the mind a little bit. It makes you smile. It plays with your emotion, and it actually is a utility that functions and it works. So I kind of rode on that theory a little bit, I also was a little bored at science. Just being honest, I just got bored because it was like 50 projects versus one project. So I got to go deep and focus on This Is Ground. So.
What's the biggest obstacle you face in your business?
So with these types of businesses, typically there's two models, right? You go off and you make a lot of inventory, and in that model, you have to invest a lot of money in procuring the material and then paying a factory, and you end up locking up a lot of money for months potentially. That presents cash flow issues. We decided to not do that at the beginning. We decided to have a local factory here and do more of a made-to-order model where people would buy it, we would then make it, and then we would just have much smaller purchases. So that model, the made-to-order model, doesn't scale. And that's the problem with that. So that's the biggest obstacle that I'm facing right now. The good news is that there's a lot of investors that will help with very specific things that you're trying to do. And paying for inventory up front. There's a lot of people out there and PayPal is actually one of them, but there's a lot of people that'll give you working capital now, and there's a price to it. And I would say be very careful about taking investment, because one of the biggest no-nos that you can do with your business is give large chunks of it away to satisfy that, oh, I need $25,000. You can find a way to get $25,000. But I would say that the cash flow and being able to fund the growth of the business is probably one of the biggest obstacles. And that's kind of an obvious answer, but that's really it.